founded in 1628, the Irish College in Rome is the last of many Irish colleges that were once scattered over Europe when it was not possible to educate priests in Ireland. Today, the college is home to 60 students, with half coming from Ireland and the others representing many different nations. Although the college's main mission is that of education and formation, it organises many different events, both for the Irish and for the wider international community in Rome. Some 250 couples celebrate their marriage at the college each year. Young people are prepared for the sacraments, and conferences are hosted on different aspects of religion, history and culture. My colleague Charles Collins was at one of those conferences just the other day and came into the office bubbling with enthusiasm for the interest a lecture on the college archives had aroused in him. "I really didn't think," he said to me, "I would be so intrigued by a talk entitled History and Holdings, the Irish College Archive." But he was, and he ended up asking the lecturer to grant him an interview.
I'm Vera Orshall, and I'm the archivist at the Pontifical Irish College in Rome.
First of all, people might be surprised, a school in Rome has archives. So what are the archives here?
Well, we're dealing with institutional archives of an ecclesiastical college, so we have all the records that pertain to such a type of institution. And at the same time, though, the sort of information you'd gather from our records is not just pertaining to the history of the college itself, but researchers come here to find out about any type of historical matter that concerns Ireland, because what is most important, we have large collections of correspondence. These are files of letters that were sent to former rectors, and this starts in the early 19th century. So this is why we're sought out, particularly by Irish historians. Obviously, most of what we have has a bearing on Irish history proper.
Historically, what's the relationship between this college and Ireland?
The thing is that this college was founded in the early 17th century, at the time when penal laws in Ireland forbade the education of priests, and this was the main reason for Father Luke Wadding, a Franciscan from Waterford, to gather funding for founding this college in 1628. So this is the reason why we're here, and we've survived through all sorts of upheavals, including the French occupation of Rome. In fact, the college had to be refounded properly in 1826.
Now, you mentioned that people come here looking for the letters. What kind of letters? People writing letters to the rector? Forgive me, for me that would seem kind of boring. It sounds like parents wondering what their sons are doing. Why are people interested in these letters?
That's right. Well, quite a few of them are boring, if you want. I am, at the moment, if you forgive me the term, I'm ploughing through correspondence from the early 1920s, and that means I'm cataloguing, that means I read every item, and I have to decipher the handwriting, and often enough, it's a painstaking work, and at the end, there isn't much said in the letter. But what is interesting is that it's not just agency matters that are brought here. That means that errands have to be run at the courier, or that errands have to be run at the Vatican for getting tickets for papal audiences. Visitors are introduced, dispensational matters are discussed. But what is important are the casual remarks on the side. So that somebody, it might be the hierarchy in Ireland, it might be a member of the clergy, or it might be a layperson, writing to the rector, will say in an aside perhaps just what the situation at home is like at the moment. And that is interesting because the early 20s, of course, is the time of great political struggle in Ireland, the time of the Civil War is what I'm dealing with right now. So you always have very interesting, casually kind of set asides like that.
Now, you mentioned this, you're studying the era of the Civil War in Ireland, and of course you probably touched on the earlier Republican struggles. What would you say you've learned from looking at these letters from that era in history?
Ooh. I suppose I have learned, first of all, a good few historical facts, because I didn't study modern history like that. I'm a medieval historian, if you want. So I've learned a lot about both sides, and I've learned a lot about how propaganda worked at the time, because you could say, to some extent, that the rectors here, they took a certain stance, and they worked at the Vatican for Irish interests, but from their own point of view. So you get a great insight into how diplomatics worked at the time. Also, I got a great insight into how, for instance, diplomatics in Paris worked, and just after the First World War, Ireland first sent delegations to Paris to the peace conference to alert people to the struggle that has already started in Ireland at that time. So I think I've mostly learned a lot about what informed both sides in that struggle.
Did you ever see get any letters from historic personages? Have you seen anything, letters that you went, oh, wow, I can't believe he wrote here?
Yeah, of course, we have some letters from Eamon de Valera, because the rector, whose papers I'm reading now, Monsignor John Hagen, was very much on the far Republican side that Eamon de Valera was the leader of. So you have letters from him, signed by him, sometimes personally signed, sometimes just copies of letters sent to other people, but sent here to inform the rector of what was going on. So the rector played a certain role in history. Other people are more, historically speaking, speaking for the history of Ireland, they're important people like Sean T. O'Kelly, but Maughan McBride, who's most famous for her great friendship with William Butler Yeats, she wrote a letter here. And there are different people like that whom perhaps the outside world would not know, people who were not conversant with the history of Ireland.
What do you say is the most challenging part of your job?
You need a lot of patience reading these letters, and I'm just honing in on that particular work of cataloguing now, but I may do so. One of the problems is that a very gifted but perhaps over-enthusiastic archivist before me put everything into chronological order, which means that it helps me a good deal, but in other ways it doesn't, because he took apart covering letters from enclosures. You know, if somebody wrote a letter and enclosed another one for information, this was taken apart, and sometimes those enclosed letters don't have dates, or else you just don't know who sent them. They might be a year out of date or something like that. So it's always a struggle putting things together. Undated letters are another thing where you're at complete pains to find out anything about the circumstances that this letter was written on, and the events mentioned might be completely marginal events that you can't find out about from books, and you'd have to be an expert, which I'm patently not. So those are the trials and tribulations of the archivist.
A point that people might not realize after hearing this, they might suddenly realize that the letters they write to institutions like this do get saved. Any advice for these would-be letter writers out there?
Well, nowadays, obviously, there's the whole new aspect of electronic records, because most letters are now written in virtual format. And that's something we haven't quite faced yet here at the college, but first of all, the letter or the email writer will be aware that things can be deleted very quickly, and that they usually are, because a recipient will not usually have a file on his computer where he keeps letters that will be for the archives. It is a big problem, of course, for future historians, but it might be a help to those email writers who are not quite certain of what they're writing, or who would rather have oblivion worked on their letters later on.
Well, thank you, Charles, for your interesting interview. Thank you.
you.